COVID-19 has disrupted hospital operations and the flow of patients like nothing we've seen before. Nowhere is this more evident than in the emergency room. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, and on this episode of Modern Practice, we're looking at improving hospital flow in the emergency department during this time of crisis. My guest today is Dr. Martin Lucenti, a colleague of mine at Vizient, and I can't think of a better person to approach to it when it comes to issues affecting the emergency room department. Marty, can you share with us a bit about your experience and your background?
Sure. I'm Marty Lucenti. I'm an ER doc by training, a little bit of an unusual background. I have a PhD in industrial engineering, so I'm an operations engineer. Did my residency in Boston, then was medical director, then vice chair of clinical operations at Northwestern. Also been in the National Guard, and 1 week in a month and 15 days in the summer turned into 3 deployments to Iraq and 1 to Afghanistan. Also did some disaster medicine in Haiti right after the earthquake. So pretty familiar with some of the disaster stuff and its implications on the emergency room.
Thanks for your service, Marty, and we're glad you're here. So first of all, give me an idea. How's this crisis affecting the emergency room departments?
Well, you know, I think it's always good when you start with a crisis like this. It's important to understand some of the first order principles of disaster response. And what you're seeing around the country, I think it's important for people to realize right now, the vast majority of the United States, the emergency rooms are actually experiencing marked decrease in ER volume. And so when I've done consulting work with ERs, I actually, you know, monitor them on an hour-to-hour basis. And I'm seeing up to 50% reductions in ER visits. I often talk about the difference between an emergency room and an acute diagnostic center, i.e. where health systems use the ER to get to the answers in a timely, efficient fashion because of its proximity to CTs, CAT scanners, MRIs, diagnostic tests, consultants, and so forth. And so what you're seeing is emergency rooms are becoming emergency rooms again, and there's less utilization of that as a place to go get an answer or referred by another doctor. So really, really, quite honestly, except for some of the hotspots and even spaces relatively close to some of the hotspots, the emergency rooms are actually experiencing pretty substantial decreases in visits.
So Marty, you mentioned that close to 50% of our emergency departments are really just at low capacity right now. But we do know that when the surge do occur, it's quick and it's heavy. How do you manage that? How do you prepare for that?
Disaster management is a really important thing to think about well in advance. And what I always tell people on disaster planning, the most important thing to do is to build into your operations agility and resilience. And so for those of you that use, you know, some of the design methodologies from complex system design, some of the high reliable system design methodologies, this is an area where you're really going to get tested. Have you built operational resilience into your operations? And so most emergency rooms around the country are experiencing, by definition, disasters each and every day, okay? Most emergency rooms, there is more patients and there is more demand than the physical capacity can tolerate. And so on a regular basis, healthcare systems have an opportunity to plan for the disaster. What's really important when you look at these things is the ability to surge up, and I call it the ability to fail eloquently. And so when you start to look at these things, what you see all too often in healthcare, what we have to do in advance of being able to surge up is to surge down. And we're seeing some of those implications. Health systems are making substantial reductions in their operational stuff and so forth. What I always say is good disaster preparedness has the ability to go well beyond your ideal capacity so that you don't have to ramp down quite as much in order to stay within your capacity limits. And I always use an example. My first day as an attending in the emergency room, there was a fire in the city. And I watched, you know, on the first day and as a newcomer, I watched our response to the potential disaster of a building on fire. We closed off and partitioned a third of our emergency room ready to take care of patients from the fire. And what came in was 3 people with minor smoke inhalation. And then I looked out in our waiting room, and our waiting room had gone from a couple people waiting to be cared for to 20 to 30 people waiting to be cared for. And so what's important to understand is this is just more emergency patients. And going to a lower productive mode on the path to being able to surge up has some fundamental design flaws. So really exercise the ability to surge up without having to surge down to surge up. Does that make sense?
You know, it does, in the sense of helping me kind of understand what you're saying. So you mentioned agility and resilience. Can, using what you're saying, can you use New York and Washington as examples?
Yeah. Well, I'll use those. And so what's always unique, and you need to have some of the, there's always unique properties of the nature of the disaster. And you should be familiar with all the intricacies of a disaster. So obviously a fire is a different sort of disaster, right? A lot of smoke inhalation. You need to have a lot of respiratory intervention. What's unique about an infectious-based disaster, a pandemic, is that you have to do a lot of advanced work in partitioning your emergency room into areas for clean and dirty. So patients that are clearly not infected, making sure that you don't expose them to folks that are infected and create a risk on that. And you need to make sure that the folks that you are unsure of whether or not they're infected, they're partitioned from each other. So you can cohort the people you know are infected. You can cohort the people you know that aren't affected, and you need to find a way to strategize to actually keep almost in near isolation all of those patients that are undetermined yet. And you need to put that process so that it reaches probably outside the emergency room, which means you've got to decide which route and characterization or triage people before actually entering your space. And you're seeing a lot of places all around the country really get a sort of an outside triage to route those people based on that. Some folks are even extending that out into their access systems, which is if you call in and you seem to be doing well, go for your testing here, or rerouting people of lower acuity to other places. So it starts with those things. And then when you start getting into, you know, how do you do this in some of those places where we're really seeing the epicenter, what's important to understand is you have to do everything imaginable to create throughput for your emergency room. And this is part of why I started with the discussion. You know, most hospitals get an opportunity to exercise, how do I deal with a disaster each and every day? And what's really important is a first order principle. I'd be remiss if I didn't say this as an ER doc. The best way to run an emergency room is that as soon as the emergency room is done adding value, there is forward movement into the care spaces. So that as the hospital gets fuller, we don't back up into the ER and essentially mitigate our ability to deal with new emergencies. And that's a big deal, because most hospitals that are running disasters on a day-to-day basis don't do that. The standard model for when you have 450 inpatients in a 425-bed facility is to have 25 extra patients in your 50-bed ER obstructing your flow. In the context of disaster preparedness, all the more important that you have a model that the emergency room does emergency care. And I'll use the example in Iraq. If you, at Ibn Sina, which is a combat support hospital that you may have seen in CNN and HBO, Baghdad ER, you know, the hospital could be 215% occupied and the ER could be essentially empty at times. And why that was is at no point when the ER was done would the patient not leave the emergency room to make sure you're ready for that next influx of patients. So real important on that front to have those things, to operate in a model where there's no outflow obstruction to the place providing the most important early evaluation, characterization, and diagnostic for your patients.
So one thing I'm definitely hearing is in reference to cohorting as a way of not only that way you can serve those patients that are non-COVID and then definitely serve those that are have COVID and avoid them infecting others. But what about in reference to your staffing? Do you cohort them as well?
Yeah, we had a previous webinar, WebEx, and we had some great advice from the folks at Yale about really making sure one of the best approaches to mitigating the rapid consumption of PPE is to actually mitigate the amount of people coming in and out of the areas with patients that are infected or potentially infected. And so similar endeavors on those fronts. And when you look at ER capacity, it's really important to understand this is a capacity demand matching problem on three dimensions. And I actually, in this context, I'd actually add a fourth. The three dimensions are, there are three things that it takes to take care of a patient. It takes a doc, it takes a nurse, and it takes a bed. And so if you only have enough, you know, if you have enough physician capacity to see 10 patients an hour, enough nurses to see 5 patients an hour, and enough beds to see 7.5, you're only going to see 5 patients an hour. If you double your nursing staff, you don't all of a sudden get 10 patients an hour. You only go up to the next constraining variable. The fourth variable I would add in this context, because we're seeing it at many of our hotspots, is actually equipment, particularly PPI equipment. Some on the inpatient would actually add that fourth variable to be ventilators. But It's really important that you are only as productive and your capacity is only as much as your most constraining variable. So real attention to aligning those resources and the functional capacity of each of those resources is crucial to make sure you're getting the most return on your resource allocation in each and every one of those care settings.
Marty, also in the same WebEx, Providence showed the planning capacity framework in which they actually broke things down into tiers and kind of look, going back to what you were saying, they were maintaining function based on the tiers. Can you kind of talk about that a bit?
Sure. So when you looked at their model, and I think it's a really nice model, is what they described as various phases of a clinical disaster framework. What they talked about is phase one is preparation. It's actually your ER is operating, getting ready to pick up COVID positive patients. So that's basically you're running in a relatively standard model. Now, once again, in a pandemic context, it would be a relatively standard model with probably an extension outside your emergency room to actually characterize risk for infection before you route into the green, yellow, red sort of areas, dirty, clean, indetermined as of yet areas. Right. So that first phase is about standard operations in search of the early cases coming in. Now, phase one is really important because it's your detection mode, but it's also your planning mode. This is the phase where you actually work out how you're going to respond as you start to get out of operational mode that fits in with your standard capacity. So getting ready for exceeding your standard capacity capabilities and moving it into a higher demand space. And so this is that phase, early detection, getting yourself ramped up, and then planning for the next phases. And what they've done is they've done a really nice job of sort of doing it, people, place, product, and then they talk about sort of the triggers to go into the next phase. But their people is sort of my doc nurse analogy, places is the beds and so forth, and then products is, you know, in this case is, you know, the constraining variables in this disaster context is actually the protective equipment and the ventilators. And so really nice job on that phase one. And now phase two is when you actually start to get beyond your typical capacities. And things that tend to trigger that is when you actually start to run low on beds, you start to run low on vent capacity upstairs, or you actually start to run short on staff. And the interventions for phase two is depending, once again, coming back to my constraining variable model, the interventions you make in phase two depend on which of those variables is constraining to you. But what's still important in this phase two triggering is it's still really, really important to understand that forward flow through the emergency room and into the hospital is vitally important. The subtleties between the phase two and what they call phase three, which is where you start to get into rationing. Phase three is sort of a rationing of precious resources. This is in the battlefield vernacular. This is what we actually start to call, you know, you start to make determinants of how do I get the most utilization out of the limited resources I have. And what I will tell you, having done a lot of disaster medicine, is you should do everything imaginable to not get into level three. Whatever it is that is constraining you, you need to find constructive ways to get around it. When I was in Iraq and when I was in Haiti, you know, when they ran out of vents, the answer was, you know, we had a medic that essentially manually bagged patients, and they just manually bagged patients. Or what you actually see in some of those scenarios is actually they would train family members to bag patients. So family members would bag patients. And I use that as an example because what I honestly believe is getting into that ethical of how am I going to shift down or accept a lower standard of care. That is a phase that I believe is almost a never situation in a healthcare setting. And I say that just because, we've had some history of in Katrina, what happened down in Katrina, people moved to that answer, much possibly quicker than was appropriate. So I always say there's probably a way to not start to get into that. Some people are getting less than standard care. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So what I'm hearing is it's basically not all or none. It should be phased based on key indicators.
Correct. Okay. And those key indicators, quite honestly, right, are which variable, the responses you get are depending on what that variable. So if your restraining variable is physicians, well, this is where you're seeing health systems make the decision to have specialists revert back to going back to being a hospitalist or being back to being an internal medicine doctor. So getting your specialist crossed. So this is where you start talking about cross training. Folks are doing a great job around the country of taking folks in areas that have lower demand because of the downshift, cross training them to be augmentation in the acute care setting. I think the other thing that you're starting to see, and I'm recording this from McCormick Place, the field hospital, the alternate care site in downtown Chicago. The other thing that you're starting to see is folks are really being proactive on setting up places that can decant the hospital, getting the folks that could be cared for in a more outpatient setting with close proximity to physician and nurse resources. This is an illness that has an unusual, it's a little bit unusual. Basically, it starts out like flu-like symptoms, and the vast majority of people recover from those flu-like symptoms. But a certain percentage of these people, somewhere in that week to 10 days out, actually start, heading into acute respiratory distress. And so there is a lot of watch and be ready for that deterioration. And so this kind of pandemic, actually, from a medical care perspective, is a relatively easy care model to expand, right? There is a lot of watch and wait and be ready for what is primarily a respiratory or pulmonary augmentation intervention. This really is something where you can be pretty progressive in sort of taking decanting some of the acute care facility patient populations into a setup alternative care site with well-trained medical professionals, watching them, looking for those signs that a patient is in that population that's deteriorating.
And there's actually some new regulatory features that makes that a lot easier for us.
Correct. Lots of stuff going on, on that front. When you set these care sites up, everyone's doing it subtly differently. Some folks are establishing these things as essentially just adjunct care sites to health systems. Those are operationally the easiest, but others are actually setting them up as medical facilities under either the state or the municipality. And you can imagine some of the regulatory issues. Here in Chicago, we're actually setting it up under the city. And so that's meant a license. It's meant a pharmacy distribution license. It's meant a DEA number. It's meant setting up wholesaler and distributor relationships and procurement processes and all of those things under the city. The challenge for this, quite honestly, is often in these alternative care sites is the logistical infrastructure. Right. Docs and nurses with minimal amount of training can walk over and take care of these patients. I'm always amazed at how standard our basic approaches to care are, but the logistics of these things, especially with the time course that you're talking about, are incredibly challenging.
Marty, we also have a podcast on how virtual care or telehealth has been a huge component and probably the new norm. How has this affected the emergency room?
Well, this is an area. So I, what I will say that will come out of this crisis is there has been, and if you follow our SG2 forecasts, there has been a massive migration towards telehealth encounters. Primarily the telehealth encounters, the things that have been done, first were some of the telehealth for the ER is in some of the specialties, behavioral health, sometimes neurology for acute stroke. You're actually seeing also some major tertiary care, quaternary care facilities. The ERs are actually providing telehealth support for some of the smaller areas. But what you're seeing is the rapid transition from ambulatory patient encounters going to a telehealth mode is really amazing. And so that capability is going to be accentuated. And it is a big part of where some of this volume that's disappeared from our emergency rooms is going. And we're actually seeing many ER staffs, actually, I think in New York, I think in NYU, I think they're actually, the ER staff is actually providing staff for a large portion of their telehealth encounters. So this is an area where you're going to see what was a rapid transition towards telehealth encounters. It has created regulatory urgency for reimbursement for these kind of encounters, and it's created demand for this. So what was a rapid transition has become massively accelerated.
And I encourage our listeners to listen to the podcast on telehealth by our professionals at SG2. It's actually a very good one. Thank you, Marty, for great information. I appreciate your efforts in helping our emergency departments manage patient flow during this unprecedented crisis. And to our listeners, please join us for other Modern Practice podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, and thank you for listening.